Get a free bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Whiskey when you subscribe to The Spectator in our Black Friday sale. Go to spectator.co.uk/Friday.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, The Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. We're now fast approaching Christmas, which is a time of year when, despite the inherent joyfulness of the celebration, and perhaps because of it, emotional and physical problems can be thrown into sharp relief. It's a difficult time of year to be ill. And it's bound to be a difficult time of year for the royal family, which, like countless families around the world, has to deal with the fact that the feast of Christmas is overshadowed by the reality of cancer. And of course, in their case, the cancer struggles of both the King and the Princess of Wales. But perhaps it's heartening to learn, as we did fairly recently, that both His Majesty and Her Royal Highness are drawing solace from their religious faith. This is something we've been told by Robert Hardman, who, in the light of the health crisis facing the royal family, has updated his biography of King Charles III. Robert has, for many years, been a leading light of the Daily Mail, and he's also that rare thing, a biographer of the royal family who's earned their trust without spinning over into sycophancy. We began our journalistic careers together decades ago on the Daily Telegraph. It's always a great pleasure to talk to him, and here's our conversation earlier. Robert, you're clearly the King's trusted biographer, and so I take it very seriously when you inform us in this new edition of your book that the King is drawing on his faith as he battles cancer. And I wonder if you could tell me, obviously a lot of your conversations are confidential, but I wonder if you could give me some evidence to support that, I think, rather heartening claim.
Yes, well, thank you, Damien. I mean, he does have a deep, strong faith that I think is often misunderstood. I think over the years we've always been very conscious that, you know, here is a, when he was Prince of Wales, he was very interested in other faiths, but we possibly didn't pay that much attention to his own. We would often see the late Queen going to church on a Sunday, but we wouldn't see the Prince of Wales at church on a Sunday. So people wondered, you know, does he go? How often? That sort of thing. And he does take these things very seriously, like anyone. His faith's a private thing, but it is very strong to him. It's very dear to him. While I was writing the book, I talked to people like the Archbishop of Canterbury, now ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, to the King's very old friend, Lord Charters, Richard Charters, former Bishop of London, people like that, who all made the point that, you know, it really matters a lot to him. He is in many ways a sort of quite an old-fashioned Christian. We know he likes the Book of Common Prayer. We know that he takes a great interest in sort of spiritual matters generally. It was interesting, actually, when I was writing the updated edition of my book on the events of this year and on how he's been handling his illness. And one of the works he's been studying very closely are the writings of St. Silouan, who I have to say I didn't know very much, I didn't know anything about, Russian Orthodox monk, and I talked to Richard Charters about this, and he made the point that this is quite sort of bracing stoical stuff. It's the watchword of St. Silouan was keep your mind in hell and do not despair. It's realistic faith. It's not transactional. It's not, you know, dear Lord, if I do this, will you do this for me? As Richard Charters pointed out to me, it's faith. It's real faith. He's someone who has, as I said, a great interest in other religions, other faiths, but that doesn't mean he, you know, he is, I think some people interpret that to mean all faiths are the same. No, he is Supreme Governor of the Church of England. He takes that very seriously. But, you know, he does see his role as acting as a defender, lowercase d, of other faiths while being defender cap D of the faith.
I wonder if you could talk about what I think of as the king's spiritual journey. Because I remember I was asked by The Spectator over 30 years ago to do a cover story on the religious beliefs of the royal family. And it was pretty clear where the Queen stood. She was an Orthodox low church Anglican. It wasn't so clear where the then Prince of Wales stood. And as far as I could work out at that time, this was before the breakup of his marriage, I think. He was living in Highgrove. He wasn't attending the local church there occasionally. As far as I could work out, a chaplain would come down and do a communion service for him. But people who'd stayed with him at weekends said that there wasn't much evidence that the prince was going to church every Sunday. That seems to have changed. Shortly after that, Charles gave his controversial speech in which he referred to himself as defender of faith rather than defender of the faith. And he suggested that choosing one religion over another often brought division and that we're all ultimately aiming for the same ultimate goal. Championing those of all faiths, he claimed, the pattern of the divine could be found through humankind. Now, that didn't go down very well with Orthodox Christians at the time, although I might point out it's very similar to what the current Pope says. But since then, I think there's plenty of evidence that the king has become a more Orthodox Christian, perhaps in more ways than one, because he later said it always seemed to be that while at the same time being defender of the faith, you can also be protector of faiths. And notice that the definite article is back in there. Mm. He sees himself as defender of the faith. And another rather unusual thing that happened recently is that a letter came to light that the king wrote to his late friend Dudley Poplack, an interior designer. I think it was in 1998. So a long time ago, he said, personally, the older I get, the more I am drawn to the great timeless traditions of the Orthodox Church. They are the only ones that have not been corrupted by loathsome political correctness. Now, that raises two questions. First of all, and if I could ask you about them separately, first of all, there's this business of being drawn to the Orthodox Church. There's so much evidence that the king is very interested in Orthodox spirituality. He's visited Mount Athos several times. His father, of course, was baptized into the Orthodox Church and extremely interested in it. And although one has read so many times of tension between the late Duke of Edinburgh and the king, a growing and deepening interest in Orthodoxy seems to have been part of the spiritual resources. And the saint you just mentioned is an Orthodox saint. Why do you think that is? Why do you think the current king feels himself drawn to the religion of Greece or Russia, very remote places?
I think in part it's due to sort of familial connections. He did go on retreat several times to Mount Athos. He has always been, as we know, he's interested in many faiths. I mean, talk to people around him, and they'll often suddenly mention some saint I've never heard of who they've had a discussion with, or he's sent them a pamphlet about so-and-so. You know, he's very well read on the subject. And in that regard, I think he takes after his father. I mean, the late Duke of Edinburgh was very interested in all this. You know, he went from being a very uncommitted Greek Orthodox as a boy, having been a prince of Greece without taking it remotely seriously, went through the sort of, you know, the British school system, going to chapel, was eventually confirmed into the Church of England, didn't take things very seriously for a number of years, but in later life really did, wrote a series of theological essays in the form of a sort of ping-pong conversation with the Dean of Windsor. They'd each sort of write
That's
each other
right.
an essay.
Michael Mann.
Yes. And he was very close to Robin Wood, another Dean of Windsor, with whom he set up the St. George's House at Windsor Castle as a sort of theological conference centre on sort of Chatham House rules, which still goes strong to this day. So there's a lot of sort of low-level religious interaction on the part of the late Duke of Edinburgh. I mean, at one point, he was even having meetings with the Pope to when he was president of the World Wildlife Fund to try and sort of cement a kind of some sort of alliance between the great faiths of the world and environmental movements. I mean, it was, you know, pretty radical stuff in its day. It didn't get that much attention because we were in the sort of 80s and 90s, and most royal correspondents were much more interested in, you know, the Princess of Wales. But, I mean, at one point there was the Pope and the Duke of Edinburgh having a sort of conference on faith and wildlife at Assisi. So, you know, there is a sort of depth to all this. And another thing, I mean, he's very mindful that his grandmother, this is, I'm going back to the king now, to Charles, you know, he's very proud of the fact that his paternal grandmother was a nun, that she's buried on the Mount of Olives. I think that's reflected in his decision to get rid of the, well, there were two reasons, actually, for getting rid of the traditional anointing oil at the coronation. One was that the usual oil was made to a formula that goes back to at least the 16th century, possibly before. And that particular recipe does involve various animal parts, including the glands of a civet cat and a substance called ambergris, which comes from the lining of a stomach lining of a sperm whale. And clearly, he could tell that that might be a cause for trouble in a 21st century coronation anyway. But also, I think he wanted to sort of bring a bit of the sort of family connection in. So that's why the decision was made to scrap the old olive, the anointing oil recipe with the controversial bits in it, so we don't get any animal rights complaints. We'll have olives from the Mount of Olives, which is where his paternal grandmother, Princess Alice, is buried. The Princess Alice, who later set up her own order of nuns, became a nun. And she in turn did that in homage to great aunt Ella, who was murdered by the Bolsheviks, thrown down a mine in Siberia in 1918. So, you know, there are these connections going back to various orthodox strands of the sort of orthodox thinking, orthodox tradition, which I think he finds very appealing. He's a sort of radical traditionalist in so many ways, and that extends, I think, to his faith. I think he feels, I have these strands in my sort of theological DNA, and I quite like sort of exploring them and occasionally celebrating them. I do think there was a very interesting way that the king did sort of deal with the defender of faith / defender of the faith issue in his coronation oath, because you can't tamper with the coronation oath, really. I mean, that is, you know, it's governed by an act of parliament. But what you can do is you can sort of add bits to the service that make a sort of similar point. So there was this moment, the sort of preface to the taking of the oath, where we saw something completely different we haven't seen in previous coronations, where the king actually he's about to take the oath, and the archbishop says, you know, "Your Majesty, the Church established by law, whose settlement you will swear to maintain, is committed to the true profession of the gospel, and in doing so will seek to foster an environment in which people of all faiths and beliefs may live freely. The coronation oath has stood for centuries and is enshrined in law. Are you willing to take the oath?" So the king replies, "I am willing." So the archbishop has effectively sort of set up the sort of the defender of faith element there, you know, that you know, people of all faiths and beliefs. The king doesn't say it, but he sort of then endorses it. So I think it's a way of, you know, I think scholars will go back through that coronation order of service and find lots of little things that show that while the essential framework of the coronation was exactly as it has been through, you know, going back to pre-Norman times, where you have the recognition and then you have the oath and the crowning and the homage, what you had this time were just these changes. I mean, I thought one of the most interesting things, having looked in detail at the 1953 coronation, which is essentially an enormous Anglican gathering of elderly white men, and then you look at the whole complexion of the 2023 coronation, which begins with a 14-year-old boy effectively saying to the king, "What are you doing here?" And the king saying, "I'm here to serve." And then you see every faith, every community somehow included and reflected in this service.
Interesting that you point out being a radical traditionalist, because even back in, you know, 1990, whenever it was I wrote this piece, it was clear that Charles was more drawn to high church worship than his mother. She wasn't at all drawn to high church worship. And one of the ways you can be drawn to high church worship and be part of the British establishment and not tainted, I don't know what word to use, with any association with Roman Catholicism is by doing it the Orthodox way. So you're drawn to Eastern Orthodoxy. And I did notice, I think it may have been at Diana's funeral, but I did notice to my astonishment, the Prince of Wales crossing himself, making the sign of cross, but in the Orthodox manner, which is in a different direction to the Roman manner. But still an extraordinary thing for a Prince of Wales to be doing. Something else that's often not pointed out is that King Charles has often been very outspoken on behalf of persecuted Christians in the world. The Reverend Angus Morrison, who's, I'm sure you've come across him, he's chaplain to the monarch in the Church of Scotland, preached to the late Queen and to this king at Balmoral, says, I have quite a close relationship with Archbishop Angelus of the Coptic Orthodox Church in London. I know that Prince Charles visited the Coptic Centre in London more than once, and when those young Coptic Christians were murdered in Libya, Charles showed a great deal of solidarity and has urged politicians to do more in defence of the persecuted church. That's very welcome and quite rare, actually. So few public figures do care about the persecuted church.
Yeah, I mean, I think one aspect of the role that he's settled into, well, I think he's settled into the whole role very, very easily and quickly. It was actually only towards the end of her reign that the late Queen started being quite explicit about her faith in her Christmas broadcasts. If you look back at the early Christmas broadcasts, they tended to be much more of a sort of travelogue. You know, we had a lovely time in India. Next year, I'm looking forward to the Commonwealth Summit, that sort of thing. Then, really, it came about in the turn of the millennium, and particularly after 9/11. Suddenly, if you look at the text, her Christmas broadcast, they suddenly become a lot more reflective. They become a lot more like a sermon, actually, which will take a line or two out of a carol or a Christmas reading and extrapolate from that sort of various themes. And that's something that he himself has done. Now that he's king, you know, in his very first Christmas broadcast, you know, he talked about sort of spiritual comfort from the light. There was a whole sort of riff on the light, the power of the light, and that's something he's clearly comfortable carrying on. I think he is, and it's very unusual for a sort of head of state of a Western democracy to be comfortable discussing matters of faith in public, but he is, and you know, because he's so well read on the subject, you know, there's nothing kind of stagey about it. I mean, I think, you know, he could have a you know, long and I mean, if he was sitting here now, I'm sure he'd be sort of just, you know, chucking out particular bits of scripture and Old Testament, New Testament. I mean, he's as I said, he's knowledgeable.
Well, I remember when the late Queen started incorporating a much more overt Christian message into her Christmas Day broadcast. I remember how well it went down. I remember my late mother was absolutely delighted by it. But Telegraph readers or Spectator readers or whatever, there was a tremendous response to these messages. And I remember saying that in many ways, the Queen had become Britain's most effective Christian leader, which actually wasn't saying very much, either at the time or now, because the leaders of the respective churches were pretty useless. Because, you know, they basically spewed out the latest secular orthodoxies with a very light dusting of liberal Christianity. And in this letter, we find Charles saying years ago that he's drawn to the Orthodox Church because they are the only ones that have not been corrupted by loathsome political correctness. But he thought that was a problem in 1998. It's surely much more of a problem now. I mean, Welby, for example, really did not distinguish himself. Welby gave one secular speech after another. Now, there are subjects on which he and the king would have been seen eye to eye, for example, climate change. But surely, if Charles objected to political correctness back in 98, he must have objected to some of Welby's endless politicising of his role.
Well, I mean, I think what you've got there is a sort of a private letter that's certainly not in any way written with the fact that it's going to be publicised. So I suppose you could argue that was a sort of a more of a throwaway remark. But I mean, yes, he... I think there is privately a greater depth to his faith, but as Supreme Governor of the Church of England, it's a bit like, you know, he has to be above politics, particularly now that he's monarch, particularly now that he is Supreme Governor. He can't really get involved in particular strands of the church and say, look, I prefer this to that. It's got to feel very big tent. But I think what we do see is that interest in quite, you know, earnest, quite severe, often quite bleak sort of orthodox views, not leaning towards sort of miracles and a sort of happy...
The Orthodox are very into miracles.
Well, yeah, but it's a more how shall I put it? As I said earlier, it's not transactional. It's not, you know, I'm going to do this and then God, will you do that? It's not in his case. I don't think he's one who's waiting for miracles. I think it's, you know, you do your duty. And you know that's at the root of faith. It's not a sort of waiting for some magical wand to be waved.
Well, Robert, in the updated version of your hugely acclaimed biography, there's one real eyebrow raiser where you talk about Prince William, and you say in royal circles it's no secret that he does not share the king's sense of the spiritual, let alone the late queen's unshakable devotion to the Anglican church. And then you talk about if he doesn't go to church every Sunday. Somebody, I think one of your sources, said he might go at Christmas and Easter, but that's it. And they also vehemently denied that William has been drawn closer to his faith since his family's health crisis, saying no change of course there. So this was partly juxtaposed with the revelation that the Princess of Wales has found spiritual solace as she faces her own terrible cancer battle, and I assume it's Christian spiritual solace, and her husband doesn't seem to share her enthusiasm at all. And if he's going to become Supreme Governor of the Church of England, you'd have to go back a long way to find a secular figure as overtly uninterested or uncommitted to Christian ideas as the current Prince of Wales. And that is making a lot of people rather anxious, particularly given the circumstances.
I mean, I think in the same way, let's just go back to you know, when the then Prince of Wales, now King Charles, when he made his remarks about wanting to be defender of faith, not defender of the faith, or as well as be defender of the faith. You know, people, Anglican traditionalists, as you said, were very worried about that, when in fact the underlying sentiment was exactly the same as the sentiment that the Queen expressed at the start of her Diamond Jubilee in 2012, when she talked about the Anglican Church being a sort of having a sort of protective role for other faiths to allow other faiths to practice freely. I mean, the sentiment was exactly the same. I think so it is with Prince William. That the underlying spiritualism is clearly isn't there. He's not as comfortable in a faith environment as either his father or his grandmother. But he's very dutiful, and the sort of supreme governor of the Church of England element of the job, if you like, that's laid down in law. I mean, that's a matter for Parliament. He will do the constitutional stuff as he is required. So in that regard, I think he will, you know, he will observe all the formalities of being Supreme Governor. However, underlining it there isn't the sort of the same spiritual hinterland. I mean, I don't think anyone goes as far as saying he's a complete atheist. He's just, as one of his friends put it to me, well, in not going to church very often, he's really just like 99% of the population. And frankly, at a time when we now have our first avowedly atheist Prime Minister in Downing Street. I mean, we can argue about which previous occupants of Downing Street may have not had much in the way of faith. But as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Keir Starmer has said that he doesn't believe in God. So to have an heir to the throne who is, shall we say, not enthusiastic is you know, at least that's something. And yeah, I mean, Prince William is, he's as I said, he's not, as it's been put to me, he's not comfortable in those sort of faith environments. He doesn't, there's no sort of quest for the inner meaning of things. I don't think he sort of lies awake at night pondering other religions in the same way that perhaps his father might once have done. But, you know, he's dutiful. He understands what comes with the job. And things like the coronation oath that require the monarch to protect the Protestant faith, that's something he will do because that comes with the job.
But meanwhile, his wife, the Princess of Wales, we are told has become more interested in faith since her cancer diagnosis. How is that interest manifested? Do we have any idea?
No.
It's an interest in the Christian faith.
It's like all things to do with the princess, particularly this year, I mean, it's very private. We've barely seen her in public. And so, you know, what's going on between her and the Almighty is obviously something that's very private, but it's been made clear to me there is, on questions of faith, it's something that she's become more interested in the course of this year, which, frankly, I would say is not terribly surprising, but nonetheless, I think it's interesting.
Robert Hardman, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Damien.
And now, if you don't mind, a quick postscript from me. After talking to Robert Hardman, I was reflecting on what a historically unusual mixture of Christian traditions inspires King Charles. We're used to the idea that the Church of England has historically been a compromise between hardline Protestantism and the vestiges of medieval Catholicism. And until the late 19th century, it was certainly true to say that the Anglican Church was much more Protestant than Catholic. Queen Victoria was effectively a Lutheran who, for historical reasons, accepted bishops, but who began the tradition of the royal family worshipping in the strictly Protestant, bishop-free Church of Scotland when it was staying at Balmoral, a decision, incidentally, that horrified some Anglicans at the time, because it involved, and still involves, what some people think of as some rather bizarre theological shape-shifting as the monarch crosses the border. Do they automatically become a Calvinist from the moment they arrive at Balmoral? The king is, without any doubt, more high church than his mother, whatever that means, but he also seems thoroughly at home in the liturgically reformed, pared-down worship of the Kirk, where the meaning of the Eucharist and understanding of apostolic succession is quite different from that of the vast majority of Church of England bishops. Anglicans and Presbyterians don't, in theory, at least, even believe in precisely the same route to Christian salvation. But if the king, like his father, now in addition draws deeply on the traditions of Eastern Orthodoxy, then he has to straddle another gulf, because the Eastern churches, while ancient enemies of Western Roman Catholicism, are implacably opposed to Protestantism. They don't even accept the bishops of the Anglican Church as being invalid orders, and many of them think that Scottish Calvinism is a profound heresy. We can assume, I think, that Charles is drawn to Orthodoxy because his father was, and his grandmother even became an Orthodox nun. But remember that the late Duke of Edinburgh wasn't really Greek. He came from a German family. There was a theologically convoluted relationship between the Protestant monarchs of Northern Europe, British, German, Scandinavian, and the radically unreformed traditions of the Orthodox East. It was a compromise made in the 19th century. Protestant monarchs allowed their daughters to marry Orthodox princes and indeed become Orthodox, or their own princes to convert in order to become Eastern European monarchs, without paying much attention to the apparently unbridgeable gulf between Calvinism, Lutheranism, or Low Church Anglicanism on the one hand, and the ancient churches of Constantinople and Moscow on the other. Partly, I think the thinking was that the Orthodox aren't Catholics. Indeed, they dislike Rome even more than we do, so let's not bother about the fine print. But it wasn't really fine print. A Presbyterian divine and a Greek Orthodox monk hold completely irreconcilable views about the sacraments, miracles, and Christian hierarchy. King Charles is supreme governor of the Church of England, but worships in the Church of Scotland and is deeply influenced by Eastern Orthodoxy, so he has to square some rather formidable theological circles, in theory. But he lives in an age, as we all do, in which orthodoxy, with a lowercase o, takes second place to the more negotiable concept of spirituality, and the freedom to be able to choose which bits of a religious tradition happen to suit you. Whether ordinary Christians care about these contradictions seems increasingly doubtful. It's not even clear that Pope Francis cares about them very much. What does seem obvious is that the king is committed to a firm, if customised, Christian faith, and I think it helps explain the extraordinary bravery he's shown in these dark but hopeful times. To paraphrase one of his ancestors, it's not our job to make a window into his soul.